The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Film Weekly with Jason Solomons. Yes, I'm back from my holidays refreshed and recharged to tear into this week's films. A huge thanks to Zan Brooks for holding the fort in my absence over the last couple of weeks. Zan will be joining me later to discuss this week's releases, and he'll also be talking to Hellboy 2 director Guillermo del Toro.
I may be a fan of Andrei Sulavsky, or I may be a fan of genre noir, but I'm also a fan of Ray Harryhausen and Walt Disney.
So Zan will be finding out about Del Toro's eclectic influences and looking at the Mexican director's next major project, The Hobbit. More of that later, but first, the new Shane Meadows film, Summer's Town, may have had a tiny budget, a reported $500,000, but this does not diminish its artistic ambitions or emotional charge. The title, Summer's Town, comes from a small area of London that lies between Euston, St Pancras and King's Cross and Camden, a stone's throw from where we are here at Guardian headquarters, and it tells the story of a friendship between two boys. Tomo, played by This Is England star Thomas Turgoose, the wandering, plucky teen from Nottingham, and Marek, played by Polish actor Piotr Jagiello, son of an immigrant worker on the Eurostar building site. Both youths find they share an affection for a French waitress, and it's this amorous awakening that forms the glorious, beating heart of this small, monochrome delight of a film. I spoke to Thomas Turgoose to find out more about his role in the film and his burgeoning acting career, but before we hear from him, let's go into Summer's Town's Greasy Spoon Cafe, where Tomo is showing Marek how to charm a lady.
So, do you like photography, arts and writing and things?
Yeah, I do, actually.
Cool. I mean, I'm actually a painter myself.
Really?
Yeah, I do everything. I do glasses, wine bottles, anything.
Really?
You name something, I'll tell you if I've done it.
A flower.
Yeah, I've done flowers, I've done fruit, cakes. Yeah. So I do women sometimes, and I actually did it wasn't awesome, but it was an okay drawing of the Eiffel Tower.
The Eiffel Tower?
Yeah, yeah.
Show it to me.
Yeah, of course I'll, yeah. Maybe I should do you sometime.
Maybe.
Thomas Turgoose, welcome to Film Weekly at The Observer. Thanks so much for joining us. It gives me a real thrill to see you back on the big screen in Shane Meadows' Summer's Town after watching you make your debut in This Is England. So in Summer's Town, Tom, was working with Shane any different to doing it in This Is England? Are his techniques the same? Did you get to improvise, or is it very strict what you're going to do each day?
Well, working with Shane was exactly the same, except I knew what was what. So I sort of knew when to do stuff, and I knew when people said something, I knew what it meant, and it was a lot easier. But it was just like being back on This Is England, like working with Shane, because of like his improvisation and or like being friendly on certain things. So it was definitely good to work with him again.
Yeah, it's very funny, Summer's Town, as well, isn't it? I think people will not be aware how sort of amusing it is, and the banter it is between you and your co-star. Because I mean, obviously, Marek is a Polish actor. Was it difficult to kind of banter off him because he doesn't speak English as his native language?
No, he was really, really good. He's an amazing actor. Actually, he's really, really I don't know what. Yeah, I mean, he come to England to do this Summer's Town, and he said that he couldn't speak all that well English. But then by the time he'd finished, he could speak pretty much perfect English, and he was doing interviews in English with me and Shane, and we was all like really impressed about how we'd done his English. But I mean, working with him, it was quite simple, because I mean it made it funny because of like his accent that he's got. The accent that he's got, his Polish accent.
Yeah.
It's quite funny, and Tomo's just like, what you want about? And I think it's just naturally funny.
Yeah. I think you're all naturally funny. And Perry Benson as well, when he kind of takes you under his wing.
Perry Benson is probably one of the funniest guys I've ever worked with. He's amazing, Perry.
Because you worked with him in This Is England as well, wasn't it? He was one of the kind of the racist skinhead gang that you were with.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
And so that Shane does like to create these little families. Is there a way that Shane sort of seems to have adopted you the last sort of 4 or 5 years? Has he been a father figure? Because I know he's about to become a father himself. Is he going to be a good dad?
Yeah, I think he'll be an amazing dad. And I'm really, really looking forward to Joe to have a baby and It'll be amazing, and I think Shane will be the best dad in the world.
Yeah, is that how you look at? I mean, I know you've got your own dad as well. I've met him.
Yeah.
So don't want to offend your own dad, but Shane has been bringing you through quite nicely, hasn't he?
Yeah. He's been looking after me in the film world, and also in my own life. Like, if I've ever got problems, then I can always ring him, and he'll speak to me, and he'll always take his time out to speak to me. So
yeah,
and I do respect Shane for that. So.
So what about your life that he's changed? Because, I mean, I know you walk down the street now, girls shouting out Tomo to you. You're a sort of a little rock star in that young people's world. I don't know about what that world is, like Facebook or something like that, but I'm assuming that you're pretty popular in those circles now.
On my Facebook, I never really get messages from my friends. It's all people saying about This Is England and they can't wait for Summerstown, and I mean, it's nice to sort of have this, and it does make you feel quite special. But then, I mean, I don't really consider myself anyone different when I'm in Grimsby, if you know what I mean. I'm just normal Tomo in Grimsby, so it's quite cool. So,
what would you say, Tomo, that you're an actor now?
I'd like to say that's what I want to be when I grow up.
Yeah, because when I met you first, when you were doing This Is England, it was like, well, I want to be a footballer. I don't really know. I've never really acted before. It wasn't part of my plan. And suddenly, you know, suddenly now you're still only 2 or 3 years on, and you're now like, I think you're going to be an actor now, mate.
That's definitely changed in what I want to do now. I definitely 100% want to be an actor.
Because you're very good in Summerstown. I think that's the surprise. You're lovely in This Is England, of course, but, you know, that could be a one-off. But in Summerstown, I think we see a side to you that is new, that you're funny, you're warm, but you can also be hurt and you can also be kind of vulnerable. Have you taken any lessons in acting since, or is it just it comes very easily to you?
No, I've not taken no lessons. The only things that I've really done is my drama at school, my GCSE, but I'd never done any acting classes or anything like that. So.
What did you get in your GCSE?
I've not found out yet. I found out on Thursday.
Be funny if you fail.
I don't think I'll do all that great because of my coursework, to be honest. But
really? Why is it? That's the written work, is it?
Yeah, and I don't think I'll do all that great in that. But I'll wait and see again.
Yeah, and well, I do hear that there's some good news this week. I think yesterday, Tomo, you got some good news. You got another part in a new film that's got nothing to do with Shane Meadows at all. What's that one?
It's called The Scouting Book for Boys. I think it's based on a book. I think I've been told it's based on a book.
Well, you'll have to get reading that book at some point.
Yeah, and it's a really, really nice script, actually, and a lot of my friends have been for parts in it, and it should be a really, really nice film to do, and I'm really looking forward to getting it filmed in Norfolk, so that should be a really nice few weeks.
Well, from me, if I was grading your GCSE acting, Tomo, I'd give you an A, mate. So let's hope that the board, if they ever get their scripts or their results down to Grimsby at the moment, the post's not too good with these things, that they come up with the same mark, because I think you're fabulous in Summerstown, and it's great to see you growing up and becoming an actor professionally. And I think I wish you the best of luck with it, mate.
Thanks a lot.
You can see Thomas Turgoose in Summerstown as it's released across the UK this Friday, the 22nd of August. And I'm delighted to say that I'm now joined in the studio by none other than the roving Guardian film critic, Zan Brooks, to take a look at this week's releases. Hello, Zan.
Hi, Jason. Welcome back.
Thank you for standing in for me for the last couple of weeks.
I can now get out of your shoes.
Yeah, exactly. You can get into Summerstown instead for us, Sam, because we just heard from Tomo there. It's a film that I've been very fond of for quite a while because it's a lovely little black and white piece of work. It's only 72 minutes or 74 minutes, they're trying to say. But I think that the brevity is the soul of wit in this instance.
I really liked Summerstown. It's a beautiful film. I think Shane Meadows is one of the most talented directors we've got around. I think This Is England was maybe the best British film of last year.
Yeah.
And Summerstown isn't quite as good, but it's very, very good indeed. It's set in the Summerstown area around St Pancras. It's a little coming of age story. It's beautifully acted. It's moving. It's also funded entirely by Eurostar.
Now, you've got a bit of a problem with this.
I have a bit of a problem with this. I was saying it's like having a really good friend who occasionally turns around and tries to sell you a sort of timeshare villa. You really like them, but you're kind of you start to mistrust them a little bit. And there are a few slightly dodgy plugs. You know, not many, just sort of dropped here and there within the film. And then, without giving too much away, the film actually does go over to Paris on the Eurostar at one stage, and it's all absolutely perfectly goddamn splendid over in Paris. And there's Montmartre, and there's the Eiffel Tower, blah, blah, blah.
I would counter this now, because, I mean, if you did live in Somerstown and suddenly this great whacking terminal was built there that's one of the great kind of homages to Isambard Kingdom Brunel, it has changed the face of that area. Somerstown is now dominated by the Eurostar, whether they like it or not. I mean, in the way that that kind of Guggenheim effect had on Bilbao, maybe Eurostar will have that effect on Somerstown, so they can hardly escape it, these residents. So perhaps that is a realistic portrayal of what's going on in that period of the certain time in a certain area of London.
It may well be, but the fact that you've got Eurostar funding this film entirely makes you suspicious of its message. Maybe you shouldn't be suspicious of its message. Maybe this is absolutely a truthful portrait. Maybe people in Somerstown are walking around saying, look, that station is amazing. My, wouldn't I like to go to Paris on one of those trains? Maybe that's what they're talking
about. Some of them, I think, are. They've got free tickets as well, some of them. I did a Q&A with the residents of Somerstown who were slightly annoyed about Eurostar funding this thing as well, because some of their pubs are disappearing and some of their lifestyle is changing. So I do think it's dangerous. I think if Shea Meadows had accepted, say, studio dollars, and so everyone and Americans have said, yeah, this is England, great, we want that guy, he'd have to kind of deal with, you know, putting Marlboro cigarette packets in his movies.
Of course he would. It's rife. It's everywhere. You know, most American films are riddled with product placement. Maybe you're even having to make compromises if you go to Film 4 or Pathé or an established, you know, production company to get money. This is what filmmakers do. This is what independent filmmakers have to navigate every single time they make a film. So it's very easy to say, oh, because it's funded by a private company, this is therefore a corrupt commercial. Not necessarily, because these things are happening all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I think Shane's cleverly subverted. I think he's taken the Eurostar dollar or euro, and I think he's subverted. I think he's played with it, and he's kind of shown a community in ebb and in flow and the difficulties of what happens.
And you know, what has to be pointed out is that I was speaking to people at Eurostar, and they were saying, we wanted to highlight the regeneration of Somerstown. Mm. Somerstown still looks kind of drab and grim. There are kind of feral youths on the street who kind of beat up and mug the Thomas Turgoose character. It's not like some paradise on earth here. So Shea Meadows isn't selling out and basically giving this kind of airbrushed Disneyland view of Somerstown.
No, absolutely. But I do think him and his cinematographer here, Natasha Breyer, who's somebody he hadn't worked with before, a foreign cinematographer, has brought this wonderful kind of sort of Godardian sense of alienation to it. It looks a bit like Alphaville. It looks a bit like Abu Dussouf. And there's this romance running through it. And I do think that Tomo is fabulous. We just heard from him. I think he's fabulous in it. He is a kind of little Belmondo in it.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, he's got the sort of the pugnacious kind of air, the dry wit. And the kind of the human side to it. The character he plays in it is very moving. It's not sentimental, but it is very affecting.
One of the problems I have with the movie, in fact, the only problem is that, again, not much happens. That doesn't bother me. But that it is so short. And I'm wondering if people who, we as critics kind of say, oh, Somerstown's the film of the week. Brilliant. Everyone leads on it. I'm sure Peter Bradshaw will lead on it. And I know Philip French is leaning on it in the weekend. Everyone says, oh, great, we must go and see Somerstown. Here's my tenor. 70 minutes, you're going, what? Where's it gone? Where is this film? It's not a night out, is it?
I guess it's not, but I'd rather see a kind of a small good film than a really, really long bad one. I kind of think most people would as well. And also bear in mind that Eurostar initially commissioned this as a 9-minute short film. So Shea Meadows has done very well to crank it out to 70 minutes.
As garrulous on screen as he is in real life. I would have just liked to see maybe tacked on some short. I haven't seen Shea Meadows' shorts for years, the Where's the Money, Ronnie, or Small Time, and there's loads of them. I'd like to see those sort of put on as a kind of
Well, when
feature.
Eurostar put out their big DVD of Somerstown, maybe they'll have those in there as well as like a little free ticket or something.
And maybe we get to see it on the back of screens in Eurostar as well. Anyway, this is not an advert for Eurostar. This is The Guardian and Observer's Film Weekly. You're listening to Jason Solomons and Zan Brooks run through the week's releases. You said, Zan, you'd rather see a small, good film rather than a big budget, big blockbuster, long film, which leads us very nicely to Get Smart this week. Steve Carell, after the flop of Evan Almighty, can he finally carry a comedy movie? He plays Agent Maxwell Smart, or Agent Number 66, and he's put in tandem with Agent 99, played by the actually quite hot Anne Hathaway.
Okay, you know what? So far, our entire partnership has consisted of me getting you out of trouble. Do you know why? It is because you keep leading.
Oh.
So here's how we stop that. I lead now. I am the one with field experience, and you know nothing.
I beg to differ. I looked up your field agent exam, and I scored...
What?
Your field agent exam. I scored 8 points higher than you did.
Classroom.
That
this
is the difference
is
between an A plus and an
you
A minus.
You are really going to get
difference
us killed
between
if
an
you
A plus and an A minus. A minus.
Shut up, you two.
I'm just cracking up even hearing that again.
This is based on a Mel Brooks TV series that was out in the 60s in England. I never saw it, I've got to tell you.
No, I don't think it probably ever made it over here.
No, it did. It did play, apparently, for about 5 years. There were about 100 episodes. They were half an hour long. I've never seen one of them. It was yet again another sort of what became very popular Bond spoofery, a genre that's still with us, with Austin Powers.
Absolutely,
do we
yeah.
need any more?
No, we don't. We don't. You know, maybe this was funny as hell back in the 1960s. They've updated it. They've you know, stretched it out. They've padded it. They've thrown lots of special effects. That you know, all of that, the bells and the whistles. It's not funny at all.
Is that the problem with it? Because it's not exciting either. Because you don't care whether they kind of
do
whatever.
Yeah, it fails
on
both counts, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it does.
You know, it revolves around a scheme to kind of assassinate the president and blow up half of Los Angeles with a nuclear device. It doesn't matter. But the weird thing about this film is that I remember when 9/11 happened, and there were all these very kind of learned, pompous pieces saying, never again will Hollywood be able to show, you know, a terrorist attack on its shores. Never again will that become entertainment. Now you've got this, which is the crassest, dumbest, baddest comedy, using it as entertainment. So Hollywood's kind of resilient, isn't it? It doesn't let these things trouble it for long.
I mean, it really is nonsense, this film, isn't it? As you say, it's not funny on any level, apart from, I thought, Alan Arkin, who plays the kind of boss of whatever covert operation this is, who's kind of just funny anyway, isn't he?
Yeah, Alan Arkin's always good value, but my God, I mean, wasn't it last year when he won an Oscar? I mean, he won an Oscar for Little Miss Sunshine, and you think, right, now he can really take his pick of the roles. Finally, he's going to get some really meaty roles to get his teeth into at last. And he goes and does this.
But people are very fond of Steve Carell as well, because his role in Little Miss Sunshine as well. And I am too, but he's not a lead actor, is he?
No, maybe not. I mean, you know, 40-year-old virgin, I thought he was kind of good in. But he just looks a little bit ill at ease in this. But the script is so bad that what are you going to do?
Yeah, I know. I don't really know what this film is doing as the big bank holiday weekend film as well, because this week there are not many films out. Next week there are about 15 films out, and I don't quite know why. A little dig at British distributors here.
It's quite weird, isn't it? Well, I guess they're clearing the way for Hellboy, which was officially out last week, but is still kind of kicking around. So they're basically saying, all right, Hellboy, you can have this. You know, we're just going to maybe get Smart up for the number two slot.
Yeah.
But also an incredible waste of talent here. You've got Bill Murray, you've got Terrence Stamp.
Well, Bill Murray's in it for about a minute.
Yes,
in a minute. Tree.
In a tree. But, you know, it's still Bill Murray. He's still there on the credit list.
He gets actually the biggest laughs. And you'd have thought he'd do an uncredited cameo, but he's like, no, I want the... I don't know if they get points per appearance, but he's certainly got one. He's probably the funniest thing in it.
Him and the tree.
Yes. Bill Murray, wooden as ever, but brilliant. Deadpan, I thought, was a description of Bill Murray. And I wonder, because I was looking at the audience when I was watching Get Smart. They were deadpan.
They were dead.
Right, let's move on from Get Smart and dead audiences to an era where most people are dead still, from the late 1960s, early 1970s, a documentary called Face Addict, which follows the travails of a photographer called Ido Bertolio, who seems to have woken up and unearthed his old pictures from the days when he was mates with Andy Warhol, and he wandered around downtown Manhattan with mates like Debbie Harry and John Lurie. And John Lurie, I think, is the person who puts that era in the best perspective.
First few times you take cocaine, it's the first couple times you take heroin, it's like, my God, all the pain has left my body. Pain I never knew was there before. And it's like, and the combination of the two, it's like, so I'm cool on the heroin and I've got energy on the coke. And then, of course, it's like it starts to, you know, your nervous system, people start getting weirder and, you know, people start falling out windows and being in car accidents and ODing and, you know, and then AIDS started, and then it just, you know, and then Reagan got elected, and then it wasn't so much fun anymore, you know.
We had Thatcher in this country.
Yeah, blame Reagan for everything.
Yeah. Reaganomics. This is not the first time that this era, this Warholian era, I suppose, like going into CBGBs, going into, I don't know, post-punk, the Ramones, Debbie Harry, all that era, seems to be endlessly explored on screen.
Yeah, I think it has a real fascination for people. I guess perhaps because it was the birth of the celebrity age that we're now all living in. So it's the wellspring for all that. So people are going back and looking at it and examining maybe for sort of clues to how we've got where we are now. This is a kind of fascinating but slightly depressing film. It was like wandering into a bar in the East Village or something and finding yourself kind of accosted by all these kind of relics from the past, all these sort of ghosts, basically.
Some of them shivering, some of them wrinkled, yeah, some of them completely
wrecks,
damaged.
Basically. Yeah, totally damaged. And they, so they start talking to you and you're listening and you're thinking, you know, this is kind of fascinating, a little insight into that world. And then you just think, please enough, just shut up, you're boring. And it gradually, they get more and more boring. They're kind of self-aggrandizing, they're self-deluding. You know, it is interesting, but you need a bit more distance than, you know, Bertolio gives to it. Bertolio is so much a part of this world himself that he's unable to kind of frame it and to analyse it.
I think what's interesting is when you do documentaries like this, which are sort of personality-led, I mean, Bertolio gives us access to that world because he was part of that world and he can ring up his mates, maybe Glenn O'Brien, who did Madonna's sex book, actually, later on, and sort of says rather pointedly at one point, this was the book that ruined my career, and we don't really hear too much about it because it was rubbish, Glenn, that's why, and you're clearly pretentious. But then he gets a sort of leather jacket out of his cupboard and he says, oh look, the Jean-Michel Basquiat drew that. It's like it's just a squiggle on the back of his jacket and it must be worth a million and he's kept this jacket. And then he says, oh, this is my leather biker's jacket, you'd have seen me wearing this. Maybe there's some drugs in the pocket. And he sort of excitedly sort of ferrets around for drugs in the lining of his jacket, and there's the cupboard is bare, and he's sort of slightly upset about this. And I thought that was terribly sad on all levels, from a filmmaker's level, because it didn't really explore anything and it just leaves us dangling there. And I was like, well, you know, you've got to, when you go into a world like that as a documentary maker, you have to reveal something.
Yeah, you have to reveal something other than it was great and now it's over and we're all absolutely broken up yeah. by that. And that's kind of all this film says. That's not to say that it isn't a great subject for a film. I mean, you know, there have been fine films made about, you know, disillusion and the collapse and the you know, the fallout from youthful promise and all of that stuff. It's all great. It's great material. But yeah, this just kind of wallows in it.
I missed sort of any explanation of the art of the thing as well, about why it was so important. Some of these photographs that we see looked quite good. And...
yeah, he did the Blondie Parallel Lines cover. I mean, you know, he's obviously is or was a talented man. But these people are just, they're kind of coasting on the afterburn of past glories, really. And not even really coasting, they're just stuck.
They're really, really drifting. There's a wonderful scene, though, that I've never seen before of Debbie Harry demonstrating how she learnt to pogo on an actual pogo stick, not wearing a bra. If you're of my age, that was kind of a big thing.
If only we'd seen that when we were 12, it would have changed our lives.
Well, talking of life-changing events, a film is out finally at the BFI this weekend down on London's South Bank. A film by Lu Ye called Summer Palace. Now, obviously, all our thoughts are on Beijing at the moment with the Olympics. This film, for me, when I saw it at Cannes almost 2 years ago, should have got a gold medal. It never did.
It was fantastic. It was the great hit of Cannes 2006 for certain people. Had a lot of controversy in its native China, which maybe explains why it hasn't appeared here, but I can't imagine that would be the reason. Finally here, playing on the BFI South Bank this week. It's a film basically that revolves around the events of Tiananmen Square. It's a coming-of-age tale. It's a tale of student rebellion. Bertolucci's film, The Dreamers, did that thing where he tried to marry kind of sex and politics. This does it better. I mean, this shows sex, particularly in a repressive climate like China, to be a genuinely revolutionary act. You know, and like most revolutionary acts, it's sort of daring, it's ennobling, and it's generally calamitous for the people involved. It's a very sad film. It's a beautiful film. It's great. I love it.
Yes, I'm very fond of it. I think Lu Ye, who did Suzhou River a couple of years ago as well, belongs to the sixth generation of Chinese filmmakers. I think he's one of the bravest and most exciting of that visually. And I think certainly with Summer Palace that we're seeing here, there's a beautiful texture and palette that he uses of colours.
It's a fantastic insight into life in China, I guess, in the 80s and possibly still now, where you have these incredibly intelligent, sensual, sexy kids who kind of dance around at the disco to sort of cheesy state-sanctioned pop. And, you know, still love it. They still love it because that's all they've got to go on. But obviously their aesthetics are completely separate from that.
Drove through the country, showed them how my motor could go. I said, how do you like my triple carburetor? And one of them whispered low.
Together now, 1, 2, 3. Keep your mind on the track, keep your head.
When we were at Cannes a couple of years ago, Liu Ye was recalled back, and China was furious that this film had been shown at Cannes because the censors were going to deny it. And I presume that was because of the footage of Tiananmen Square that they call the reconstruction of Tiananmen mm-hmm. Square that was in there. Whether that's now been sanctioned by the Chinese government, I don't know.
And I'm sure it hasn't. I remember going to a press conference in Cannes where Liu Ye was being asked about this and being completely flummoxed because Liu Ye was saying, I am very surprised that China is annoyed with this film. I will cut whatever they want me to cut out of it. I have, you know, I'm so upset that I have shocked them with this. You know, I had no intention of doing that. And thinking, why is he saying this? And then someone, of course, says he has to say that. There's no, you know, he cannot go up against the Chinese authorities. He almost has to play the innocent. Like, I can't imagine why you'd have a problem with showing Tiananmen Square. let me repair this damage.
Yeah, well, I do think it's a fascinating film, certainly in recent Chinese film history, and also as an insight, a peek behind that curtain that we never really got to see back in those days. And now that we're seeing so many images of China, even though they're mostly fronted by Gabby Yoroth and Sue Barker, I must say, that would inspire Tiananmen Square as well. Lean jingoism that the Brits are putting into coverage from China at the moment as well. But nevertheless, I would go and see Summer Palace because I think it is a far more realistic portrait of Beijing that we're getting from the Olympic Games. And I think a really fine, fine piece of work. Zan, thanks for joining me to run through the week's releases. But of course, you mentioned one of the releases from last week, Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, which is kind of the film of this week and of last week. I know you and Peter Bradshaw discussed it on Film Weekly last week. I'm not a big fan of Hellboy 2 or of Guillermo del Toro at all, so I shall let you handle this part.
Well, Peter loved Hellboy 2. I kind of liked it a lot, but Peter really adored it and actually said it was a better film than Pan's Labyrinth, which is, you know, Guillermo del Toro's Oscar-winning film from 2 years ago. You know, del Toro is, I guess, the sort of the geek of the group of Latin American filmmakers that include Alfonso Cuarón, Alejandro González Iñárritu, Walter Salles, Fernando Meirelles. You know, this buena onda, this good wave of Latin American cinema that has kind of made a big splash in recent years. He kind of divides his career very nicely between these sort of big flamboyant Hollywood blockbusters and then these slightly more exotic Spanish language films.
I love The Devil's Backbone.
Devil's Backbone is marvellous. I spoke to Del Toro this week and I asked him about Hellboy 2, obviously. And I also asked him about the plans for his next film, the eagerly anticipated adaptation of The Hobbit. First, I asked him to clear up a very alarming rumour, which is that he actually sees himself as Hellboy.
Well, not to an alarming point. I love the character that much, but I don't think I'm that good looking.
You don't have the tail.
I don't have the tail, nor the horns.
But he is at least slightly autobiographical?
Oh, very much so, yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, many of the scenes between him and Liz and just scenes that I write for him in the movies come straight from my own experience. I was not born to destroy the world or to be the beast of the apocalypse.
That's a relief.
Or not that I know of.
Or was it an opportunity to kind of delve deeper into the Hellboy mystique?
No, because I always saw it as an opportunity to do things differently. It was not rethreading steps previously taken. That would be a mistake. It was to break new ground. You know, anytime you do a sequel, or in my near future, a prequel, you know, I think that you can take it either as an opportunity to construct something new, or a challenge to match something already made. And I think the first position is the interesting one, when you think, well, how can I expand and change and mutate the existing stuff? How can I make it, how can I slant it in a way that benefits the story? And I think Hellboy 2 was a perfect example of that.
And as a sort of fan of the original comic books, presumably there's a lot more material there. I mean, can we expect to see a Hellboy 3, a Hellboy 4 from you at some point?
I would love to do a third one. I will definitely do. I would love the third movie to be the end of this particular movie incarnation of Hellboy. Obviously, other people can come in, chip in, and do Hellboy the early years, or they can do whatever they want. But in my mind, the possibility, the expressive interest is to do three movies. But if there's no third movie, I would be equally at peace. You know, it would be two more movies than I would ever thought I would get away with.
Now, I've got to pick you up on something you were mentioning earlier, which is the prequel that you're working on, which is obviously Tolkien's The Hobbit, the prequel to The Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. How much freedom do you have with that? I mean, you're coming in on the back of Peter Jackson's trilogy, which had a very distinctive look and feel. Mm-hmm. You've got Jackson there as an executive producer. Are you able to do with this film exactly what you want to do with it?
I would hope so. I mean, that's the understanding. The understanding is that we are creating and serving a very different tale than the trilogy. You know, I think the book in and of itself is a very different book than the Ring trilogy. It has more of a fairy tale aspects to it, you know, but at the same time, it goes from it goes to a very interesting tonal change. The book starts as a really golden book, and it then falls into a very strong dramatic impulse, and it becomes much darker towards the end. So, you know, I think that so much of the book is areas geographically and thematically, and monsters, creation of monsters thematically, all of it different from the trilogy. You know, you're exploring areas that are completely new, so they can be completely fabricated.
I mean, I agree that it's a very different book. I mean, it was seen as more of a children's book than Lord of the Rings. I actually think it's a more satisfying book than Lord of the Rings. Do you agree with that?
I would say that I can only say that my first impulse when I read it at age 11 was I read that book in a single sitting, The Hobbit. And at that early age, I could not get into the trilogy. Mm. I attempted it and I could never get into it. I only read the trilogy in the last 12, 14 months, right. You know. So I think that it felt absolutely organic when I read it. It felt like the invention in the book was happening before your eyes. Mm. It unfolded in a very organic, the flow of the book was impeccable.
Now, moving on, there's lots made in the press about the way you seem to divide your career between what might be seen as risky Spanish language films like Pan's Labyrinth or, mm-hmm. or The Devil's Backbone, mm-hmm. and then these sort of big Hollywood productions like Blade or Hellboy. Mm-hmm. Do you see that split or not?
I must say, not until recently. I really have a hard time distinguishing. I do try to come out for air when the Hollywood movies proved to be oppressive, like Mimic. I made a very conscientious effort to do a Devil's Backbone on my own terms. But I as far as expressive interest is, they are all things I want to tell. So it may be telling or not, but the three movies of mine that I like are Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth and Hellboy 2.
Right.
You know, so those are three movies that represent who I am in equal measure, in a strange way, because I may be a fan of, Andrei Sulavsky, or I may be a fan of Jean Renoir, but I'm also a fan of Ray Harryhausen and Walt Disney. I mean, I am a guy that likes, and those extremes are represented in my work.
And they can all coexist.
I think they should coexist. I mean, whenever I read, I love reading essays on literature by writers, and it can be the lectures that Nabokov did on Don Quixote, or his lectures on European literature, or Lafcadio Hearn's writing about other writers. And I love when those people show eclectic taste, like Jorge Luis Borges. shows love for Robert Louis Stevenson, or he can show love for a completely obscure Czech writer with equal passion. And I think that we should allow ourselves to exist as storytellers without only seeking the image of prestige or pure entertainment. We are not pure creatures by any means.
Guillermo del Toro, well, keep straddling those highbrow and lowbrow camps and bringing them all together. And thanks very much.
Thank you.
Zan Brooks talking to Guillermo del Toro there, and Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, is currently on release nationwide. You can, of course, read more of Zan's musings on the art of cinema by going to guardian.co.uk/film. But that's all we've got for you this week. Next week, it's a bumper week for new releases. François Ozon's first English language film, Angel, and a misty memory of 90s New York, The Whackness. We'll have reviews and interviews for all of those on Film Weekly next week. I'm back in the Observer with my column Trailer Trash this Sunday, and I'll be back on guardian.co.uk with Film Weekly next week. For this week, thanks to my producer Jason Phipps as ever, and from me, Jason Solomon, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.